Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, who expresses growing concern about the anti-abortion climate in the new Congress and in state legislatures. Ira Kurzban, an attorney representing exiled Haitian president Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who discusses the hidden forces that may have encouraged ex-dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier's return to Haiti. And Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause, who explains why the conflicts of interest of two Supreme Court justices in the Citizens United campaign spending case should cause the controversial ruling to be vacated. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
International arms inspectors say China has emerged as the top arms supplier to civil conflicts, replacing Russia, which dominated the small arms trade in the 1990s. In Sudan, which supplies China with crude oil, Beijing now provides the Khartoum government with over 70% of its small arms and light weapons. So far, there is no direct evidence that China has violated arms embargoes in the Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Ivory Coast. The likely violators, say arms inspectors, are African governments or arms traffickers who legally obtain Chinese-made weapons. The Progressive magazine reports the FBI spent 2 years infiltrating the Twin Cities Anti-War Committee, including gaining access to the group's financial records and becoming knowledgeable about the personal lives of key committee members. An FBI agent using the alias Karen Sullivan joined the anti-war group in April 2008 and helped organize protests against the Republican National Convention. The undercover FBI agent regularly participated in weekly committee meetings, helped out with bookkeeping, and traveled with the group to the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. Sullivan's role as an FBI spy was uncovered at a press conference by the anti-war committee, where Jess Sundin, a leader of the group, discussed the role of Sullivan, who many of the peace activists had considered a friend. In late September, Sundin's house was raided when the FBI arrested 14 peace activists in Minneapolis and Chicago. Sundin says the anti-war committee was engaged in lawful activities, and she claimed the actions make a mockery of our democratic rights as outlined in the Constitution. Federal prosecutors brought 23 activists before a Chicago grand jury on January 25th as part of a still-secret government investigation into material support of terrorism. The shocking suicide of Rutgers University student Tyler Clementi, who jumped off the George Washington Bridge last September, led to a wave of suicides by gay teenagers and increased focus on the bullying of gay teens. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, social conservatives sought to blame the rash of suicides and bullying of gay teens on gay rights activists. A prominent Christian right leader, Tony Perkins, of the Family Research Council, blamed gay activists for exploiting tragedies to push their own agenda. GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, has been a prime target of right-wing attacks for pushing school districts to adopt measures to stop anti-gay bullying. Civil rights groups say violent hate crimes are increasingly being committed against gays and those perceived to be gay. Recent public opinion polls find the public now blames anti-gay messages coming from conservative pastors as a major factor in the increasing number of suicides among gay teens. This comes at a time with growing public support for same-sex marriage and the repeal of the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy toward gays in the military. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
During last November's congressional campaign, the issue of abortion was barely raised, and GOP conservative candidates ran mostly on economic issues, calling for jobs and balancing the budget. Now that the new Congress has been seated, pro-choice groups are counting a majority of anti-choice legislators in both the House and Senate. On the 38th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling legalizing abortion, pro-choice groups are dismayed. Despite not campaigning on abortion issues, the first legislative proposals to come out of the House deal with reducing funding for women's health programs, including birth control, and placing new restrictions on access to abortion. Representative Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey, is the chief sponsor of Bill H.R. 3, which goes under the deceptive title No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, and what some are calling STUPAC on steroids. The bill goes further than Representative Bart Stupak's original failed legislation by forcing millions of Americans to pay more taxes if their health plan covers abortion care. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She talks about some of the anti-choice proposals at both the federal and state levels and what the movement to protect a woman's right to choose might expect from the country's so-called millennials, Americans under age 30 for whom abortion has always been legal.
They ran on jobs and the economy. They did not run as being anti-choice. And the first order of business was to take up issues that are going to attack a woman's right to choose. I mean, in the Congress, we have what we call STUPAC on steroids. They're talking about cutting to family planning and Title 10. This is birth control for women across this country. So, yeah, they say one thing, and their actions are another.
What about the issue of choice in state legislatures, many of which have flipped from Democratic to Republican, with many more Republican governors now?
Yeah, let me just mention three to you. For example, in Nebraska, we call it the Nebraska abortion ban or copycat ban. It was modeled after a law targeting Dr. Leroy Carhart. So, in effect, it bans abortion at 20 weeks without an adequate exception for women's health and for cases in which the pregnancy was a result of rape or incest or fetal anomaly. So this is a really dramatic bill, and we're seeing other, you know, started in Nebraska, now spreading across the country. Another one is banning insurance coverage of abortion in state-based health systems. Again, these anti-choice lawmakers are trying to make it illegal for health insurance plans to include abortion coverage as a basic benefit. So let's just talk about that for a second, because if you keep in mind that 90% of health plans offer that coverage right now. So banning it would have a terrible effect on women's access to basic essential care. And the third one, and you're seeing this one pop up a lot of places, is the forcing women to view an ultrasound before abortion, even if it is against their will. We believe that women should have the option of an ultrasound if they request it or if their doctor recommends it for medical reasons. But these politicians out there want to override a doctor's recommendation, mandate that a woman view an ultrasound image regardless of the situation or what her doctor says.
Does anyone know what difference viewing an ultrasound has on a woman's decision whether to go through with an abortion or not?
You know, somebody like Guttmacher or somebody might have a better sense of how that data is being drawn up. You know, I'm not out there in every clinic, so I mean every woman has a different situation. But I think the point here is not how what effect it has ultimately. It is that they are mandating a medical procedure without her permission. It is the interference of politicians in that decision between a doctor and a woman. And again, like we said, they should have the option if they want one, but they should not be mandated.
Nancy Keenan, is this the most anti-choice Congress ever seated since Roe v. Wade in 1973?
You know, I don't know if it's the most anti-choice Congress ever seated, but it is so dramatic to what we had over the 06 and 08 elections. You know, we've never had a fully pro-choice Congress, but the numbers were moved dramatically in those two election cycles, and we've basically lost ground.
So the Republicans in the House just voted to repeal the health care reform law. They won't succeed, but that law contained a lot of important provisions for women's health, right?
This was a law that provided prenatal care for women. They voted to repeal that, and it had the promise of birth control for millions of women in this country. Here again, if you can prevent an unintended pregnancy, you can reduce the need for abortion in this country. So they're not looking for solutions here. They are just looking to attack.
Abortion's been legal since 1973, and in almost 40 years, millions of women have grown up without that history of the struggle. Do you see a split in demographics in terms of the people who are willing to go to the barricades on this issue?
We just embarked almost a year ago now, we're just in another phase, but embarked on what we call the Millennial Research Project, taking a look at those young people, you know, 30 in that age bracket and under, and their attitude about abortion care. What you find is that they are very pro-choice, but they do not connect yet the personal with the political. They don't see that that personal holding of that belief is something that they act on politically. And that's our challenge, quite honestly, as an abortion rights advocacy organization. It's our challenge to get them to connect the personal with the political. These millennials are the most diverse in the country. They will represent about 40% of the voting electorate in about 10 years. So you see the political power they have and will have in us continuing to defend the freedom and privacy of women and the right to abortion.
That was Nancy Keenan of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Contact the group's Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-973-3000 or visit their website at NARAL.org. The return of ex-Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier to Port-au-Prince on January 16th caught his nation by surprise, as most Haitians still struggle to recover from last year's devastating earthquake and deal with a disputed presidential election. The former president for life ruled Haiti from 1971 at the age of 19 until he was driven from power and into exile after a popular revolt in 1986. Both Jean-Claude and his father, François Papadoc Duvalier, who had led Haiti since 1957, have been accused of committing gross human rights violations and looting the impoverished nation's meager treasury. While Baby Doc said he had come to help his nation after last January's earthquake that killed an estimated 230,000 Haitians, there was speculation that he had really returned to Haiti in order to manipulate a banking law to release $5 million frozen in a Swiss bank account. Not long after his return, Duvalier was charged with theft and misappropriation of funds and is also being sued for torture and other crimes against humanity. During their reign, 20 to 30,000 Haitians were killed by the tyrannical father and son's paramilitary force, known as the Tonton Macoute. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with attorney Ira J. Kurzban, who represents exiled former Haitian president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Kurzban, who won a $500 million judgment against Jean-Claude Duvalier, discusses the green light he believes Washington gave Duvalier to travel to Haiti and covert U.S. maneuvers to block Aristide's return to Haiti from exile in South Africa.
There is no way that Jean-Claude Duvalier would have come back to Haiti unless he got the green light from both U.S. intelligence and French intelligence. And I believe he did that. And the probably clearest sign that he did it with U.S. intelligence is that the person who is the head of his security is someone named Jodel Chamblain. Chamblain was the head of a death squad that was set up in 1993 after the first coup against President Aristide. And there were detailed reports in Nation magazine, other magazines in the United States, that he and his co-founder, who was someone named Emmanuel Constant, were working for both the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. When Aristide came back in 1994, Chamblain disappeared. He reappeared in 2003 as the head of the so-called rebel army with Guy Philippe, which really was about 100 people who were well-organized, well-financed, and well-equipped, who were the people who came into Haiti and created the basis for the United States to ask Aristide to leave the country, and eventually, according to Aristide, kidnapped him and took him out of the country. And Chamblain, you know, marches triumphantly into Port-au-Prince at the beginning of March of 2004 after Aristide is kidnapped and taken out of the country, and then he disappears again. He reappears last week when Baby Doc came back to Haiti as the head of his security. So to me, that's certainly a indication that American intelligence is involved in this operation involving Baby Doc. Well, what does that mean? It really has two parts. The first part is baby doc sought $6 million in Switzerland, and the Swiss government froze the money. A court in Switzerland reversed that freeze and was going to give the money to Duvalier, and then the Swiss legislature passed a special law that goes into effect at the beginning of February. That is a law that essentially says for persons like Duvalier and others, Mobutu and others who have taken money from their countries, the Swiss established this law that says, in effect, if a country where money has been taken illegally, as was the case here, is unable to prosecute the individual either because he's out of the country or because the institutions in the country are weak, then we, the Swiss nation, will return that money to that country, even if they haven't actually ultimately and finally criminally prosecuted the individual. Duvalier shows up in Haiti to establish that he's there. He was going to leave 3 days later to then go back to Switzerland and say, I went to Haiti, they did not prosecute me, and therefore you have to turn the money over to me, even under the new Swiss law that's coming into effect in February. The intelligence community has a different reason for him to be there. And I think what they're really trying to do is reestablish Duvalierism and Duvalierist politics in Haiti, which means death squads, Tantan Macoutes, you know, where you have a very strong right-wing takeover of the country.
Attorney Kurzban, as former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's attorney, and someone I'm sure you've been talking to in recent days, what are his intentions with regard to public announcements that he's made about his desire to come back to Haiti, given the events with Duvalier's return?
Since 2004, President Aristide has sought to return to Haiti. He's made a number of public statements. He made a very strong statement after the earthquake last year, asking to return to Haiti and saying that he was ready, willing, and able to help. And he made a similar statement this past week, seeking to return to Haiti as quickly as possible. There are two stumbling blocks. One is he does not have a diplomatic Haitian passport. His passport expired, and he's called upon the Haitian government to provide him that passport, which they can easily do if they wanted to. The second is that he needs the cooperation and assistance of the South African government to leave that country and to go back to Haiti. There were WikiLeaks reports in the last several weeks on the U.S. government's role in keeping him in South Africa. Some of those were from the previous administration under Bush and Condoleezza Rice pressuring the Brazilians, who are running the military operation in Haiti, to pressure the South African government to keep Aristide in South Africa. And it was interesting this week what the State Department had to say about Aristide's return. In regard to Duvalier, they said, well, that's a matter for the Haitian government and the Haitian people to decide with respect to his prosecution. But when it came to Aristide, they were quite adamant in saying, the State Department spokesman said, we don't think that it's a good idea for Aristide to come back. So it's kind of distressing that this administration, especially where one had hopes that there would be a change in foreign policy, is really towing the same line as the Bush administration as far as Haiti is concerned.
That was attorney Ira J. Kurzban, who has represented exiled former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide since 1991. Read more about events in Haiti at HaitiLiberté.com. January 21st was the first anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case that by a 5-4 decision ushered in an era of unlimited and unaccountable spending by corporations and labor unions in U.S. election campaigns. The court upheld the doctrine that money is equivalent to speech protected under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. As a result of this ruling, campaign spending in the 2010 congressional midterm election increased by 330% over funds spent in 2006. The group Common Cause alleges that Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia had what appears to be serious conflicts of interest in the Citizens United case, which should have forced them both to recuse themselves from hearing the case and voting on the ruling. In formally asking the U.S. Justice Department to conduct an investigation into the matter, Common Cause cited Thomas and Scalia's attendance of one or more closed-door political strategy meetings sponsored by Koch Industries, a major funder of conservative campaigns and a primary beneficiary of the Citizens United ruling. Another possible conflict in the case cited by Common Cause was Justice Thomas's nondisclosure of his wife's employment with the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank, and her role as CEO of Liberty Central, a conservative group politically active in the 2010 election. Thomas has since filed amended federal documents acknowledging that he had omitted his wife's employment from annual financial disclosure forms for 6 consecutive years. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bob Edgar, president and CEO of Common Cause, who explains why he believes the Citizens United case ruling should be vacated.
So on the first anniversary of the Citizens United case, we did a little investigation, and we discovered that 2 of the Supreme Court justices that voted on the side of the majority, the conservative side, 2 of them had been going and attending a meeting hosted by the Koch brothers, who run the second largest business in the United States. And for the last 30 years, the Koch brothers have been trying to elect House and Senate members in Washington who will serve the corporate interest and not the public's interest. We discovered that Justice Scalia went in 07 and Justice Thomas went in 08. And suddenly in 2009, the Supreme Court took a very narrow case around Citizens United, and they expanded that case dramatically and not only indicated that corporations have freedom of speech, but said that corporations are persons and should, in fact, have many of the rights that individuals have. Therefore, they should be able to spend all the money that they want. On Thursday of last week, we sent a letter to the Attorney General asking the Attorney General to investigate our allegation that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas had a conflict of interest. We're specifically focused on them having intimate relations with an awful lot of conservative partisan political organizations. But in Justice Thomas's case, it even goes further. His wife headed up a group called Liberty Central, and in our investigation and research, we discovered that Justice Thomas for 13 years had failed to report his wife's income on a mandatory financial statement that all justices and federal judges were supposed to report on. And Justice Thomas went back and resubmitted, corrected 13 years of false statements where he checked the box on his financial statement that his wife had no income. And one of the interesting things today is he said the problem was he didn't understand the form of financial disclosure, and made me laugh to think that a Supreme Court justice couldn't fill out a simple financial reporting form and yet has to deal with so many issues that impact on all Americans across the country. We hope that this will put a little chill in the hearts of the justices to recognize that their justice is for all the people.
Bob Edgar, talk a little bit, if you would, about the role of the Koch brothers, these multimillionaires who have funded the Tea Party groups and other right-wing organizations across the United States. What is their involvement specifically with Justice Thomas and Scalia?
Well, Charles and David Koch, these two multibillionaires, have for 30 years funded much of the conservative think tanks and conservative efforts to elect public officials who are really representative of corporate interest. These two gentlemen have seminars out in Palm Springs. They're having one this coming weekend. What they've done is they've put their money into secret efforts to campaign against elected officials. They have put their money behind candidates that support oil interest and coal interest and health care interest and insurance interest. And we just think that much of that money, because of Citizens United, could in fact be money that comes from foreign governments. It could be money that comes from defense contractors. And it's clearly a lot of money that they themselves have put in as industrialists here in the United States. And we just want to expose that.
Bob, legally, what kind of hurdles do you have to get over to prove the idea that there was indeed a conflict of interest here with these two justices in the Citizens United case? The next question, what happens if they do find, the Justice Department finds that there was indeed a conflict of interest and the decision in that case is vacated?
Well, it gets very complicated. First thing that has to happen is that Attorney General Holter has to agree to do the investigation. Then he will assign some of the Justice Department folks to investigate the connection, check out the information that we've shared, and we have an invitation from the Koch brothers that brag about having Scalia and Thomas appear before their workshops and seminars. These are secretive events, closed to the general public, closed to the press, and we'd like to know what was discussed at those events. Maybe they were simply innocent meetings, but if there's any evidence found that there was conversation about how the justice's decision on Citizens United could have been impacted both before and during the course of the Supreme Court's action, then the Solicitor General would present that to Chief Justice Roberts and call upon Chief Justice Roberts to pursue remedies within the Supreme Court. If the finding is true, that they would vacate the Citizens United case.
That was Bob Edgar, President and CEO of Common Cause. Contact the group by calling area code 202-833-1200 or visit their website at commoncause.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.